Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Later this hour, we talk about the film Lost Nation, a revolutionary-era war drama that resonates today. But first, we're going to talk politics with Peter Baker, New York Times chief White House correspondent, and Susan Glasser, staff writer with The New Yorker. They are the authors of The Divider, Trump in the White House, 2017 to 2021. And they'll be speaking next week at the Cape Cod Speaker Series. Welcome, Susan and Peter.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, so glad to be with you.
So before we get to some of the issues that we're facing today, let's go back to President Trump's first administration. You cover that in great detail in your book, The Divider. It didn't take long for the normal constraints of the presidency to fly out the window. There were many who never thought he would be elected. No political experience, no military experience. He was a name everybody knew, but not always in a positive light. I can't help but think that the reality program, The Apprentice, had a lot to do with perception many came to have of him. What do you think it was that resonated with his supporters?
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up The Apprentice because I recall going to a number of focus groups with voters, Trump voters, people who maybe later came to reconsider that. And that came up again and again and again, this idea in their head that he was the character that he played on TV. And of course, it was a character that he played. So many people had the idea, and I think it persists to this day, that Trump was a brilliant businessman, that he was going to bring these values of sort of shake them up, outsider business culture to a kind of sclerotic government bureaucracy. But he's a creature of the media. The part they should have taken away is not that he was a great businessman, which he wasn't, but that he was a great character actor on television and a creature of television. I think that that helps explain the Trump presidency, actually.
You want to add anything to that, Peter?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, he created an image of action-oriented guy, right? You're fired. And I think that that you know, if it's about the merger of politics and entertainment. You know, it used to be those were relatively separate spheres. And today we look at politics the way we look at a reality television show or one of those fighting competitions and so forth. And we're rooting for the Hulk Hogan of the political arena, in effect. And I think that that merger of those two spheres lent itself to his rise.
Yeah, reality TV, which is not reality at all, right? There were clues or signs how his presidency was going to go right from the start, right? Talk about that first Situation Room meeting.
Well, you know, taking us back, I mean, it's been a wild ride over the last 10 years, but there was in our book, we write about the very first moment when the kind of professional national security types as sort of exemplified by the then chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joe Dunford, a proud Massachusetts man, I should point out, he is a carryover chairman of the Joint Chiefs. We're supposed to have nonpartisan national security officials in this country. And they have the first meeting in the Situation Room with President Trump in his first term. And it's clear he starts ranting about South Korea and televisions and his hotels and all sorts of wild stuff. So these guys retreat pretty quickly into the office of the White House chief of staff, the first of many, as it would turn out, Reince Priebus. And, you know, Dunford still thinks that it's going to be okay. And he says, well, okay, you know, just let's not freak out too much. And once we figure out what the Trump doctrine is, then, you know, we'll be able to have a real process here. And Jared Kushner at the time, you know, still in the inner family circle and the ranking family member on the White House staff, he says to Dunford, you don't understand. That's not how this is going to work. And to me, I always thought this great moment when official Washington wakes up to the idea that this guy doesn't care about their briefings, their facts, their policies. He's just going to be blabbing on in the Oval Office, and they're going to have to somehow turn that into policy. And on any given day, that policy might be exactly the opposite to what the policy was the day before.
Yeah. Peter, you've covered now six presidents. When did it become clear to you this was going to be very different?
I think from the moment we realized he was going to win, he was, look, it's funny. I had covered enough presidents going back to 1996 that I had started to think that they were all, there were more similarities than differences in some ways. Obviously, some were Republican, some were Democrat, but the dynamics that shape a White House, the options and the challenges that confront a president, relatively similar, and the way they operate was not all that different. You have those meetings in the Situation Room, and you would have a process. You'd consult with people on the Hill and diplomats when you want to make an important decision and all that kind of stuff. And from the very start, he made clear that he didn't roll that way, that he was going to do things his own way. In fact, it's worth remembering that his only experience up until the presidency in business was owning a family-owned firm with no shareholders, no board of directors, only himself to answer to, basically, and his lenders. And it was he thought he was going to run the government that way, that if he would snap his fingers, that people would respond and do what he thought they ought to do, just like they did in Trump Tower. And that's just not a way government works, right? Government is about separation of powers, different branches of government, Congress, and so forth. And I was on a plane with him once. I was on Air Force One with him once. He had just come back from a dinner with Xi Jinping, the president of China, and he was waxing jealous of how Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, could do all this stuff without having to worry about agencies and Congress and the courts. If he wanted to put somebody on trial for fentanyl distribution, he said he could put him on trial in the morning and execute him by the end of the day. And that's the way it worked there. And he acted as if that's the way he wanted it to work here, because that's what he was used to.
I think if you look back on Donald Trump's career prior to being president, there is one guy who had a major influence on him and continues to this day. Roy Cohn, you have a chapter. I was so glad you had a chapter on this guy, the ghost of Roy Cohn in the book, because this was like his mentor in a way, right? This is really influences a lot of what he still does today. Talk a little bit about Roy.
I'm glad you brought that up. Other than Donald Trump's father, who was a very formative and very critical influence on his life, and frankly, I think we can, not look too much farther than that if we want to understand some of the pathologies that are clearly now shaping our national and international politics. But Roy Cohn was, in many ways, as close or as influential on Donald Trump as his father. And he was, of course, the legendary mob lawyer, prosecutor who worked with the McCarthy Committee early in his career. And that lament, you said the chapter title in our book is The Ghost of Roy Cohn. It literally hung over the White House at times. Donald Trump constantly in the search for a kind of killer weaponized on his own behalf, a legal killer. And that's what he thought of as Roy Cohn. And he learned a kind of scorched earth politicization and politics of the law, using the law as war by other means. He was almost Trump's Machiavelli in that sense. And at a formative period in the 1970s and early 1980s, it was Roy Cohn who Trump would speak with multiple times a day. And I think he never has stopped searching for the kind of consigliere who would do his bidding, who would bend others to his will. I believe it was Cohn who even negotiated the prenup in Trump's first marriage, for example. And yet, this is so fascinating about Trump in terms of how he demands loyalty from others, but doesn't always give it. When Cohn, who was a closeted gay man, got AIDS and ultimately died, it was Donald Trump who cut him off, froze him out. This man who had been as close to him as a father. I think it's a very important relationship to understand if you want to understand how we got to where we are.
And he has said it, in the first presidency anyway, there's not, no Roy Cohn with the lawyers that he has, right? He brings up Roy Cohn's name a lot looking for that. Loyalty, you mentioned this, loyalty is the trait above all that President Trump, I was going to say admires, but it really is demands, right? Yeah, that is his thing. Loyalty is his thing. Does that come from his father? Does that come from the training from his father?
Yeah, I think it comes from his father, and I think it comes from Roy Cohn. I think that, yeah, absolutely. And remember what his father would tell him. He says, "You're a killer." That was the phrase his father used, and that was meant as a compliment. That was meant as the highest form of compliment, which means, as Donald has come to interpret over the time, is that loyalty to you is the be all and end all. As Susan said, he doesn't always show loyalty to others in return. And anybody who betrays him will pay a price. He has said, "If you hit me, I will hit you back 10 times as hard." That's his philosophy of life. And I think that that defines his politics as well. And it's, for him, it's all a Manichaean zero-sum game, right? If somebody else is up, then he's down. If he's up, somebody else must be down. And I think that there's no such thing in his world as compromise, even though he does compromise all the time, but he doesn't admit it. No apologies, no compromise, no backing down. At least that's the image he wants to project, because that's what his dad told him to do, to be a killer.
Yeah. It's interesting to read Donald Trump's take on what I guess he might call his ego, others might call narcissism, right? He thinks that's a positive attribute and that never backing down. Talk a little bit about how he sees that when people call him, you know, a narcissist, which a lot of people do. What is his thought on that?
Well, in one of his ghost-written books, he actually says essentially that that's a big positive. But of course, he would say that,
Right.
right?
Everything's
He
a positive.
actually did. He did
He
actually,
did.
put that in writing under his name. Donald Trump has a big ego by any standard of a job where everybody who's ever had it, more or less, there's maybe a couple exceptions, has monstrous egos. And, I think that's what kind of scares me in some ways about this transition from Trump's first term to Trump's second term is, what happens to the unchecked narcissist and, without any as many obstacles and constraints in his way, you can see that he's going for more and more and more. And I think that's a big difference between what we saw in the first term, where he kind of raged and fulminated openly at times against the checks, even from his own staff that were put upon him. And now, in a moment where there's much more accommodation, where institutions, even far outside of the formal lines of government, are falling in line to Donald Trump. You don't see him saying like, "Okay, great, that's enough. Thank you very much. I'm
Right.
so glad. I'll stop now." Of course not. When universities like Columbia or Brown this week settle for him, what does he do? Does he say, "Oh, that's great. I've had enough"? No. He's actually the. I thought it was notable that his administration said, "Well, here's a whole new round of institutions that will come under attack." And so what I see is that the ego expands to fill the available size when it comes to Donald Trump. So now it's not enough for him just to try to set government policy. He's entering spheres of American life that we've never seen before and projecting his will, his ego, into what kind of formula Coca-Cola should use for its drinks in America, for how we should live and what our universities should be allowed to teach us. And it's the never-ending kind of expanding scope and scale of Trump's ego that seems to me to be one of the defining aspects of his second term in office.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Peter Baker, New York Times chief White House correspondent, and Susan Glasser, Stepfreiter with The New Yorker. They're the authors of The Divider, Trump in the White House 2017 to 2021. They're going to be speaking at next week's Cape Cod Speaker Series. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tell us about the meeting you had with him at Mar-a-Lago for the book. I mean, mean, right, intentionally lies all the time. And I kind of wonder, does he even realize he's lying? Or is it just, you know, I mean, what is going on there? It's so easy to check some of these things, but he is so insistent and changes stories all the time. Tell us about that first meeting.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so we interviewed him twice for the book at Mar-a-Lago in 2021, the first time in April and the second time in November. And you're right. I mean, as an author, as a historian, and as a journalist trying to reconstruct events and understand what happened, he's a very unreliable fact witness, right? You can't ask him what happened at this meeting, what was going on this, who said this to you or whatever, because he will just completely either invent or deny as he decides that it suits his desires. And it's a good question as to whether he knows what he's saying is not true or not, because a lot of people will debate this. Some people close to him say, look, the first few times he may understand what he's saying is not true, but ultimately at some point or another, he kind of convinces himself. It becomes the reality in which he's created. Anthony Scaramucci called it the reality distortion field that he put around himself. But we found that directly in these two interviews, because we asked him at the first one. It was early on, April 21, when people were starting to get the vaccines, and some of his own supporters were most skeptical of it, most reluctant to take it. And we asked him, well, would you do a public service announcement to reassure them? This is one of your biggest accomplishments of his presidency, right, is to develop this vaccine to try to end this pandemic. He said he was proud of it. Would you try to encourage your supporters to take it? Tell them it's safe. Yeah. The administration is, the Biden people have asked me to do that, and I'm thinking about that, he said. Other presidents have done it. Come November, when we go back to Mar-a-Lago, he had never done it. We asked him, well, what happened to that PSA you were thinking about doing for the vaccine? He said, what would be a PSA? I was never going to do a PSA. I never thought about doing a PSA. Who told you that? And of course, he was the one who told us that. And did he not remember? Did he make it up in April and then forget about it by November? Did he lie in November? We don't know for sure, but it wasn't true, obviously, because he was the one who told us about it in November. Yeah. What had happened in between? Well, he mentioned the vaccine at one of his rallies, and he got booed. He got booed by his own supporters, and then he stopped talking about it, decided it was a political liability rather than an asset. And it's interesting about that, because I think that the revealing thing about that, aside from his own, you know, reality bending habits, is we often think of him as the master of the MAGA movement, but it's also clear he's also kind of its hostage, right? That he feels like he couldn't brag about the vaccine, even though he had previously, because it would be politically damaging. His own people didn't want to hear it. And we're kind of seeing a little of that today with the Epstein thing.
Yeah. I'm going to get the Epstein scene in a minute, but first let's talk to Jane, who is giving us a call from Centerville. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
What's very frustrating listening to this today, and I'm a big fan of Peter Baker, and is that we continue to stay, and mainstream media continues to stay focused on Trump and his craziness. We know it's there. He's so outrageous, which makes for good news. But what's really operating, he's our shiny object. But what's really operating behind all of it, while we watch his craziness and try to figure it out and understand it, which most of us cannot, I'm glad you mentioned Roy Cohn finally, but is what's going on with the Heritage Foundation and Leonard Leo, Kevin Roberts, the Supreme Court, and Palantir, I believe, Peter Thiel just made a sale to Palantir regarding some electronics and voting machines. And these are huge issues that are operating in the background. And it really concerns me that we don't take deeper dives, and I have to find it on Substack. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't, you know, believe the first thing I read, believe me. Mm-hmm. But this is concerning that we're so focused on him. He's the perfect shield. He was for Putin.
Yeah.
Because that's what we focus on while horrific things are happening.
Yeah. Jane, Jane, thanks for the call. What are your thoughts for Jane, Peter?
Well, look, I totally understand. I totally agree with that. This is one reason why the Times has literally dozens of reporters working on stories like the one you're talking about. The whole Project 2025 thing, the first people who ever wrote about it was the New York Times. My colleagues, Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan and Charlie Savage and some of the others spent months and months and months in 2024 coming back at that again and again and again, looking at the implications, looking at the authorship of it, looking at what was being planned. So I understand what you're saying totally. And there is a shiny object quality to Trump. But it's for the news media anyway, we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to both, we cannot lose sight of the things he says and does that attract attention, because those are important too. But we also devote enormous resources to the story that's less told or less seen. Not every media has the capacity to do that. I understand that. You may not see it as much on television, but believe me, at the Times, that's something we take very seriously.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Jennifer is calling from East Ham. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning. I'm a big fan. I've read all your books. Thank you for your work. I have a double question. I do want to hear what you think of the Epstein situation. And related to that, I know you're a journalist, but I'd love your opinion on what can bring him down. What can stop this guy?
Right.
You know, are there some court cases that can interrupt him? I can't deal with the cruelty. I can't deal with the craziness. It's really, I love the New York Times. I read every damn article, but there are some days when I have to skip to the art section because I just cannot digest my breakfast if I read the hard news. So again, thank you for your work.
Yeah, Jennifer, thanks. Maybe it is the Epstein case that will bring him down. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, look, I think first of all, we're all sympathizing with that point of view because I think outrage overload is the point in a way. And the metaphor in Washington that people have used over the last decade of this outrage overload is the boiling frog, right? That we're living in this slowly overheating water. And at this point, we're all the boiled frog. Let's be real. It's impossible to focus on any given story that would have been a huge, possibly presidency ending or certainly wounding event in any other era in our history. Trump, that's just any given Tuesday, right? Is a scandal that would bring down another politician. And I think that speaks to the moment that we're in. And it also goes to the previous caller, I have to say, right? It's not that the New York Times or some of our other media outlets aren't doing incredibly important, hard-hitting investigative reporting about the many scandals in Washington today, whether it's Donald Trump and his family's monetization of the presidency, which in and of itself, I think, is something we don't talk about nearly enough. He is literally taking the presidency, turning it into a marketing vehicle to enrich himself and that of his family. Clearly a scandal of massive proportions for any other president. And it's not that we're not covering that. It's not that we're not writing about that. It's that our collective capacity to focus on that is diminished by the outrage. And then the other aspect of it, which is the weakening of our institutions and the lack of accountability. And that at this point is almost inherent, it's baked into the new definition of the presidency that Donald Trump has helped to write. Why? Well, number one, impeachment. This man survived two impeachments. What he showed is that impeachment, the one tool that our founders envisioned in the Constitution for constraining and bringing to punishment to bear on a rogue president, it doesn't work anymore in our highly partisan system where members of Congress basically have party identification is more important to them than institutional prerogatives. And so basically, Trump has proven that impeachment is toothless. It's not a real remedy against a president. And then you add to that the Supreme Court's presidential immunity decision last year in 2024, which was the precursor event to Trump returning to office and has reshaped the presidency for him and for any presidents to come. And I know that's a long answer, but I think it's so important because we've been waiting, those people who are critical of Trump or worried about his excesses, for some big external event, some knockout blow. And let's be real that, if even his attack on the legitimacy of the 2020 election, culminating in January 6, 2021, if even that didn't spell the end of Trump as a political phenomenon in this country, there's not going to be one moment
Right.
when this just sort of magically disappears from our society. And I think that's a reality that's been very, very hard to accept for people who still have a different definition of America.
Well, that and that's it, right? I mean, you have people who look at, say, January 6th completely differently. I'm talking about Americans, not politicians, but it's like how can we have such, you know, differences in what we're seeing in front of us? I guess that's part of the issue, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, we are increasingly a divided society, and you know that's actually why we called our book "The Divider," because it's not just that society is divided. That certainly predated Trump's rise and was a prerequisite for it, but of course, it's now being exacerbated as a conscious political strategy, and he is somebody who, it given the choice between bringing people together and ripping them further apart, he's always going to go in the direction of ripping people further apart. We are such a polarized society, and what scares me is that increasingly, it's not just that we might have, cultural differences between Massachusetts and Missouri, but that we're now going to have legal differences too, that we're going to live in increasingly different societies with different forms of government, different laws, norms, rules, regulations, as well as news outlets, culture, and that's the kind of separation that it's hard to see how it's going to be reversed and go back in the opposite direction of unification.
Yeah. Peter, what about the Epstein attention? Trump's trying to get people to drop it. It seems to be some of his supporters are kind of going, wait a minute, let's release those files. What are your thoughts on what's happening with that?
In some ways, it's fascinating. It's one of the most fascinating stories we've seen with regard to Trump, because it is a rare time when he and his base seem to be directly at odds, right? That there have been moments like the vaccine we talked about, like the Iran strike recently, where there were some elements of his core supporters who weren't very happy or comfortable or whatever, and he managed to maneuver to either bring them back in the fold or move the story on quickly enough that it didn't matter. Epstein is the one that really has legs, it seems like. It's the story that isn't going away, no matter how much he tries to distract attention or focus people on other things or tell them to stop thinking about it. And it's because he is a conspiracy theorist himself, like we've never seen in the Oval Office, certainly in modern times. So he stoked doubt in government, in the deep state, he likes to call it. And surprise, surprise, if you stoke public doubt and public faith in institutions, they're going to be doubtful when you're in charge of the institution too. And now suddenly the deep state, as he calls it, reports to him, and he's not fulfilling the promise that they felt like he made to expose the elites who are part of whatever it is that they think has happened with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, a lot of these MAGA people who are upset at him aren't upset because they think he is in the files and think something he has done wrong, but they just are convinced that he is not, he's covering up or not helping uncover whatever they think is going on there. On the other side of it, of course, Democrats now jumping in, and they are in fact highlighting, Trump's relationship with Epstein and the reporting by our friends at the Wall Street Journal about the body letter that he wrote to Epstein is only fuel that. That conversation reminding us of their friendship. Now, that doesn't mean he's anything wrong. There's nothing in the fact that his name is in the files would hardly be surprising because they were known to be friends. We don't know what the fact that his name is in the file means, but it certainly lends itself to lots of questions, and it's not going away.
Yeah. All right, Bonnie's giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I wasn't going to call, but I'd like to know from the reporters, do you take any responsibility? Does the national media, particularly the New York Times, take any responsibility for having helped create this situation in terms of the way corporate media covers these events, covered Donald Trump, covers the elections, Hillary's emails, et cetera, et cetera?
Bonnie, thanks for the question.
Yeah, I mean, look, part of the crisis in the country right now is a crisis of trust in all institutions, and that includes the media. And it is, in part, a conscious strategy on the part of many politicians, not just Donald Trump, to attack the media. It's not an accident that the phrases fake news or enemy of the people are so indelibly associated with Donald Trump. And you know, it breaks my heart really, because I don't think we're going to get out of this until we can start trusting each other again, our institutions again. You know, I think Donald Trump is an incredible crisis for the media, and that he reveals the weakness in this, as in all institutions. That's what he's great at. He's an X-ray to other people's souls, right? Or institutions' souls. He finds the weaknesses, the broken bones. And you know, there's a lot that's broken in the media today, in part because we're dealing with information overload. I'm sure every day on this radio show, you hear from people who say, "Why didn't you cover this? Why didn't you cover that? Why didn't you cover this?" And of course, we can always point to a story where we did cover, but the question is, did we get to the essence of something? What is the impact that we're making? That's a lot of what people are talking about. And you know, I have a different take in what's broken. I don't think that the problem is that journalists aren't covering Trump. Of course, we're, you know, doing incredible amounts of reporting, some of it very, very excellent investigative reporting. Donald Trump is the most covered figure, including by first-rate investigative reporters of our lifetime. The problem is that the social contract with media is broken. When I was growing up as a young journalist, right, there was this idea that, you know, sort of sunlight is the best disinfectant, that we, the reporters, would pick up the rock and show you all the creepy crawly things underneath, and then somehow the system would kick in and would work and figure out what to do about all those scandals that we unearthed by giving sunlight to it. And that, I think, is broken. That's not happening anymore. Accountability has disappeared from the system, and the question of what to do with this reporting, I think, we don't know how that's going to work. And you know, we haven't even talked about the AI era. I mean, you know, that's going to be and is already the big crisis. So I don't have an answer there, but I hear what your caller is saying, and you know, it's heartbreaking on some level.
The other thing too here, aside from like the distraction and the chaos, Donald Trump also he's it's not that somebody he's disagreeing, right? It's like they're evil. And that's a you we didn't we've never seen that before in presidents going. I mean, you know, that they're somebody they disagree with is now, you know, this evil person. Talk about how that plays, you know, in the public perception, and adds to these conspiracy theories, right?
It fuels this us versus them, politics, right? And it's not to say that politics haven't always been divisive. They are. They're meant to be on some level. The system is built for conflict and competition of ideas and competition of parties and so forth. And there's certainly been rough and tumble moments in politics and presidents who played it kind of on the edge. But we've never seen a president, not in our lifetime, I think, who has so overtly cast his rivals not as people he disagrees with, not as people he thinks are wrong, but as people who are evil, as you just said. In fact, the much more I did a search on this recently. You know, in his first term, he used the word evil. It's something he uses somewhat frequently, but he used it mostly with terrorists or even immigrants, which of course is also a dis issue where he vilifies and demonizes immigrants. This term, he's not only vilifying and demonizing immigrants, as he's doing quite a lot of, he's also now extended the word evil to include Democrats, Republicans he doesn't like, journalists, and so forth. And when you say that somebody is evil, not just wrong, but evil, it's a way of justifying actions that go beyond the norms, go beyond what presidents typically do, what the standards are. And if you're somebody else is evil, then arresting them doesn't seem like it's such a extreme thing, right? Just the other day, he was asked, "Well, should you arrest Alejandro Mayorkas, who was the Secretary of Homeland Security under Biden, because he was so bad at the border?" Well, whether he's bad at the border or not, we can argue about. But Trump says, "Yeah, we should look at that." He then tells Kristi Noem, his Secretary of Homeland Security, to look at that. Now, he may not actually follow through on that, but the mentality there is somebody should be arrested from the other party because I didn't like their policy or I didn't like how they executed their policy. That's a whole different kettle of fish. That's not saying that this guy did something wrong criminally and therefore there ought to be an investigation. He's saying it's possible that he should arrest and imprison a member of the other party's administration because he didn't like the way they handled a policy issue. That is just not something we would have seen by Reagan or Bush or Clinton or Obama or any of these others. And I think that it's, you know, we have that happens now so frequently that it's not even commented on as very much because it's just business as usual. He says these kinds of things with some regularity. He previewed this for us as far back as 2016 with a locker up, you know, chance at the rallies. But at least in that case, when he was talking about Hillary Clinton, there was an FBI investigation. You can make some argument that there was a, you know, question of whether a crime had been committed. The FBI ultimately determined not to prosecute, let's remember. In this case, he's not even talking about things that are crimes. He's just saying, I don't like you. I don't like what you do. I don't like your policy. I don't like that you're against me.
Peter Baker and Susan Glasser will be talking more about this at the Cape Cod Speaker Series, August 11th at Cape Cod Community College. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Looking forward to being there.